Broadcasting from the heartland of America.
In the Hoosier Media Network studios.
The next generation in conservative talk radio. This is the Voice of Reason with Andy Hoosier.
Yes, it is. What's up? Welcome into it. It is the Voice of Reason's weekend edition, the greatest time of your entire weekend. I know you look forward to it every single week. I know. It's okay. Being a Hoosier-holic, it's something you can get addicted to and stick on each and every week. So great to have you along for the ride. Again, this is the Voice of Reason. I am Andy Hoosier, broadcasting out of the heart of the nation in Wichita, Kansas, on our flagship in the Hoosier Media Network studios all over the country, radio stations all over, and we got more coming on each week. So excited to announce some of those as we go along. You can find us on our social media at Hoosier Reason, H-O-O-S-E-R, Reason. And, of course, our website at HoosierReason.com. Got a couple programming notes for you real quickly. And then we have a guest right out of the gate here, which I'm excited about. First off, we have a new streaming way that we're doing things. Our partners over at OpsLens, they're doing things a little bit differently. And now we have our video stream on our website at HoosierReason.com. So do me a favor, go to HoosierReason.com. You can go to the live page and then you can actually see the video. There's a chat room on there. You can actually comment. We will be checking that throughout and it's really neat. So appreciate you guys checking that out. Of course, all of our social media, which we're broadcasting live on as well, and our podcast, which leads me to the big issue. I have to thank you guys immensely. We have officially hit, and Chad, you're going to enjoy this. We have officially hit 100,000 downloads on our podcast, which is amazing. So thank you guys. That is a huge astronomical thing. It's not like in a monthly, so we still have ways to go. I'd like to see that every month, but we're getting there. But the fact that we have hit 100,000 downloads is absolutely amazing. You guys are awesome. The show is growing like a fire in Kansas in the wildfires here in the prairies. But it's awesome. We love you guys. Appreciate it so much. All right. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. There we are. All right, let's get into what's trending here because we have a lot to talk about. And we have a guest right out of the gate, man, a good friend of mine, as we get into our latest here.
What's trending today?
As you know, we wrapped up this week, which, and you know, I'm kind of a numbers dork. So we wrapped up this week in Washington, D.C. with a spending bill being passed, which we didn't really know a whole lot of. We're still trying to break down some of the details of a $1.2 trillion government spending bill to avert the government shutdown. The scary, fearful government shutdown. The Senate passed it on Thursday, apparently 74-24, with the House ramming it through 286-134. To talk about that, we had to bring our guest on the program. He's a good friend of mine. He's my congressman here in the 4th Congressional District in the great state of Kansas to give us a recap as he is on the Ways and Means Committee in the House.
Let's go to the Hoosier Media Hotline
to talk about some of that and more from the 4th Congressional District here in Kansas, my good friend, Congressman Ron Estes. Congressman, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Andy?
I'm doing so good. It's so good to get you on here, and I appreciate you jumping on for the weekend. What a way to ram through a bill here at the end of the week, isn't it, Congressman? We didn't know much about this one. We didn't apparently abide by the 72-hour rule that we wanted to have to avert this government shutdown. But, Congressman, I want to start off with the fact that explain the process of this one to me, because I was under the assumption that we had passed like 11 of our 12 appropriation bills already through the government. So we only had one appropriations bills left, which was our military homeland security. And then this guy comes out. Is this what this was to compensate for that? What's the deal here?
So, no, actually, I mean, the House originally last year in 2023 was able to pass 7 of the 12 bills before September 20th. The Senate had passed, I think, 2 or 3 through the committee, and then okay. They were looking at additional processing. So as been typical customary fashion for the last 25 years, instead of getting the job done by September 30th so we can start the fiscal year October 1st, they'll do a continuing resolution, which basically means we spend – the same amount of money under the same programs that was set up in the prior fiscal year. And that's been continued twice now after it started with the Speaker McCarthy. And then after the vacate in the chair occurred and Speaker Johnson was kind of under the gun to keep the processing moving forward. So one of the things Speaker Johnson did was split it into two different sections instead of having all 12 appropriations bills to fund the discretionary part of the federal government. He split it into Originally, it was 4 and 8, and then during one of the three different continuing resolutions, it ended up being split 6 and 6. And so the first 6 were passed by the House and the Senate at the beginning of March. I think it was March 8 was the day. And then the other 6, the remaining 6. So the first 6 were the easiest ones. They're the ones that are, less argument about. In this last 6, it included funding for Department of Defense, included funding for Homeland Security, included funding for Health and Human Services and the Labor Department, Education Department. Ones that ended up getting a little bit more politically contentious through this process. So this was the final appropriations for the discretionary funding for fiscal year 2024, now that we're halfway over.
Now that we're halfway, we're 6 months into the federal budget now. So we spend $1.2 trillion on that final appropriation. So now it's all done. But talk about some of the details, because I know that there's some heat about what's in this bill, about funding late-term abortions or not including immigration in this bill or whatever's being thrown out there by the media. Is that true or not? And what's actually some of the details in this bill? Because I've heard there's some good for the actual national defense and military, but what else is in this?
Yeah, and this six, you're talking about $1.2 trillion, but that's just for the 6. And if you add all 12 together, it was over $1.7 trillion in total. There were some good provisions in this bill. I mean, it included a 5% pay raise, 5.2% pay raise for our troops. And with as bad as Bidenflation's been the last 3 years, that's an important part to help them actually take care of their families and take care of themselves. But there were so many, in a lot of cases, earmarks. The old earmarks have reared their head back up and adding a lot of funding for all of these, for so many locations, centers that actually provide abortion and support to that, and LGBTQ centers. So there was a lot of horrible slush spending in here. And the same thing that's most sad to me is that last May, the House and the Senate passed the debt limit bill, which was to limit spending for 2024 at $1.59 trillion. And here we are 8 months later, 9 months later, and they couldn't contain themselves, had to spend more than that in addition to not getting the job done. So it's really creating a bigger and bigger problem for us as we continue to focus on, the debt's continuing to grow. It's over $34.5 trillion now. And actually, in calendar year 2023, it grew by $2.6 trillion, the debt did.
Wow.
And we've got to get serious and focus on that. And so some things have to be done differently. There's certainly a lot of Republicans that want to address that. And there's a few Democrats. I mean, I'm working with a few in a bipartisan group trying to talk about ways we can do this. But overwhelmingly, we just got to change the way we're doing things.
We really do. Yeah, we're talking with Congressman Ron Estes from the 4th Congressional District here in the state of Kansas, my congressman here in the south central portion of Kansas. Moving forward now, like you said, we are 6 months into our federal budget. So it's good that we've actually passed now our appropriation bills to fund us for the rest of the way. Now begins the conversation for the 2025 federal budget. Any optimism that we can have that one done by the actual time that the 2025 federal budget kicks in, which is October 1 of this year? Can we actually get that ball rolling now?
So, there's a possibility for it, but we've got to break a lot of bad habits that we've gotten into over the last 25 years to go through that. One thing that I'm optimistic about is, not only am I on Ways and Means Committee, but I'm also on Budget Committee this session. And we have passed out of our committee a budget for next year, which actually is less than what was just appropriated for 2024. So we're gonna work with the speaker to bring that to the House floor and get that budget passed. And typically the way it does at the federal government is the budget's supposed to set the template for what the appropriation dollar amounts are. Unfortunately, for so many years, that's been waived and ignored through the process, and appropriators just go with whatever they can agree to with leadership from the House and the Senate and the White House. So hopefully we can be able to drive our budget this year and address the excess spending that we've got over the revenue that's coming in, and be able to help drive down our deficit, which ultimately means we can focus on how do we get our debt down.
Yeah, we're going to have to. And for those that don't know that are listening all over the country, you and I have known each other for a really long time because you are our state treasurer here in Kansas for a while, now being congressman on the budget committee, on the Ways and Means Committee. So you're a numbers guy and you understand this and you're seeing the financial cliff that we're getting close to, which, like you said, we have to address this and change some really bad habits, which trying to tell Washington, D.C. to change habits is a very difficult thing to do for sure. But while we pass the discretionary funding that's done now, we've talked about this before. The mandatory spending portion of the federal budget continues to grow, which is roughly 70 to 80% of the actual federal budget. And we're not even touching that. So it's nice we're finally starting to even talk about discretionary. But we got a whole other beast that we have to start addressing here, don't we?
Yeah, we really do. And unfortunately, it gets caught up in the politics. And you even heard it at what President Biden was calling his State of the Union address, was, you know, going out saying, well, I'm not going to allow anybody to cut Social Security. And problem is, with him sticking his head in the sand like that, what he's admitting that he's going to do is cut Social Security recipient checks by 23%. And in the meantime, you know, as we talk about $34.5 trillion debt right now, that doesn't include the increase in the cost of Social Security, increase in the cost of Medicare, increase in the cost of Medicaid. Those I call them automatic spending programs because there's really nothing mandatory. Everything can be changed. But it's a matter of we've got to focus on so many issues out there. And if we don't start working now to protect and preserve Social Security, it's not going to be the benefit that our seniors expect and need. And the same thing with Medicare and Medicaid. Our interest payments are becoming so big, they're starting to crowd out other things. Next fiscal year in 2025, our number one payment by the federal government will be for Social Security checks. The number two payment will be interest on the debt. Number three payment will be for Medicare. And the number four largest payment will be for our Defense Department. So already we're pushing defense down behind interest and these other automatic spending programs.
Which is wild because that's supposed to be one of the main priorities government has. I'm not sure in the Constitution, Congressman, where the other social programs of Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, where that stuff's supposed to be the top priority for government to focus on, because I thought it was supposed to be national defense, which is pretty wild. Congressman, we got about 20 seconds left here, but now that this is done, are we going to when do you guys actually start the conversation for the next fiscal year's budgets?
So we're in the process with budget. At the same time, the Appropriations Committee will now start to take up their planning for 2025. I would expect that they'll have some of the subcommittees working in April and May. We'll probably be voting on the floor of the House in June and July on the appropriations bills, with a goal that the Senate would approve them by September.
I like it. That is the goal. We'll see if we can follow that guideline and that deadline for sure. It's Congressman Ron Estes from here in the 4th Congressional District for the state of Kansas. Good friend of mine. Keep up the fight, my friend. It's always great to talk to you. Appreciate it very much. Got to take
All
a break right
great.
Back here on the Voice of Reason. Stay here.
This is the Voice of Reason with Andy Hoosier. It's America's political therapist. This is the Voice of Reason with Andy Hoosier.
Yes, it is. Welcome back into it. Thanks again to Congressman Ron Estes coming on the program. Always great to chat with him. He's been a personal friend for a very long time. When I first got into my radio career, he was running for the state treasurer in Kansas, and him and I hit it off. We did an interview. Years later, when he's running for Congress, is when we took the show to the next level, moved out here to Wichita, where I'm based out of now. And him and I have been chatting for a long time. So great individual. And you know what? It makes me feel a little bit better. While I still don't like a lot of the stuff that's in this bill, and obviously we had an opportunity, I still think the Republican Party caucus as a whole had an opportunity to include some stuff and hold it ransom, so to speak, until we could actually get some stuff done. Because guess what? We have the ability to do that. And Democrats do that every single day. I love the fact that the congressman was able to explain things just a little bit better. The $1.2 trillion was not just one single bill, was not just one appropriations. As we heard, that there were 12 appropriations, and six of them passed the first part of the month. The second round of the appropriation bills was this $1.2 trillion. Now, there was concerns about the Department of Homeland Security. That was the last appropriations piece that hadn't been agreed upon. So I think a lot of things got thrown into that, and we still didn't follow the 72 rule, and we still did some really shady things, I think, to ram it through to avoid a evil government shutdown. But at least it's now we understand the $1.2 trillion, while it's still vastly way too much money, it's six appropriation bills, not just one. So that makes me feel, I guess, 10% better, knowing that it's at least more than one thing, because I would have lost my, you know what, radio edited FCC unappropriate word if we ended up seeing that as just one piece of the appropriations. Now, again, remind you, out of 12 appropriations, that's only roughly 20% of the entire federal budget. 20%. And that's absolutely ridiculous. So $1.2 trillion is only one half of 20% of it. That's only 10% of our funding. So you can see how out of control our government spending actually is. Because of how this was actually done, the ramming through the bill, the not abiding by the 72 hours, by Republicans not actually having a spine and actually being able to include some things in there like the immigration bill that we really need to get passed. There are a lot of conservatives very upset with this bill, including Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has already put up a motion to potentially remove Mike Johnson from the Speaker of the House position that happened on Friday.
Breaking the 72-hour rule. This is a betrayal of the American people. This is a betrayal of Republican voters. And the bill that we were forced to vote on forced Republicans to choose between funding to pay our soldiers and, in doing so, funding late-term abortion. This bill was basically a dream and a wish list for Democrats and for the White House. It was completely led by Chuck Schumer, not our Republican Speaker of the House, not our conference, and we weren't even allowed to put amendments to the floor to have a chance to make changes to the bill. I filed the motion to vacate today, but it's more of a warning and a pink slip. I respect our conference. I paid all my dues to my conference. I'm a member in good standing, and I do not wish to inflict pain on our conference and to throw the house in chaos. But this is basically a warning, and it's time for us to go through the process, take our time, and find a new Speaker of the House that will stand with Republicans and our Republican majority instead of standing with the Democrats.
There goes Marjorie Taylor Greene. Not very happy with Mike Johnson putting that on the floor, and I understand the frustration. And we have to have a conservative sect that's willing to do this, even though now that we're only going to have a one vote majority in the House of Representatives because of people that apparently don't feel like just fulfilling their actual obligation to stay in a seat until the end of their term. Like, I don't know, Mike Gallagher from the state of Wisconsin, which we're dealing with right now, with him saying he's going to leave by the end of April, that we're now down to a one vote majority in the House. But if Republicans actually united under, I don't know, conservative values, that one vote majority would still be a one vote majority where we could actually hold up legislation until we could get our agenda across. That doesn't happen, though, because we get those one or two or three that feel like, yeah, why not work with Democrats? Can't let the government shut down. Lots more coming up. Stay here.
This is the Voice of Reason with Andy Hoosier. Truth, reason,
and common sense.
This is the Voice of Reason with Andy Hoosier.
Common sense, that's what it's all about here on the program. That's what we do each and every weekend. Again, find us on our website, HoosierReason.com. We are coming up to the end of the month next week, which, hard to believe. Can you imagine? Next week is Easter weekend. I almost said April Fool's Day, which is the day after Easter. That's the holiday, April Fool's. That's the holiday right there. Easter, what's that? Oh, it's April Fool's. That's right. Easter would be the weekend holiday, and then we actually have April Fool's Day after. See, April Fool's, I got you. Well done. All right, let's do this, baby.
We'll do it live.
Do it live. That's what it's all about. Let's go right back to the guest hotline here as we shift gears a little bit. I've always been curious about this topic. I'm really excited to have our next guest on the program.
Let's go to the Hoosier Media Hotline.
as he is a protest expert and CEO of the organization Crowds on Demand, as we talk about how in the world, I've always been fascinated by seeing the crazy rallies that so many have, and especially when college kids feel like they're changing the world, man. How do we actually get people to be excited to actually be effective at actually doing some type of rally and actually getting engaged, especially going into an election season? Happy to have on the program Mr. Adam Swore. Adam, how are you, my friend?
Andy, it's great to be on your program. Happy to have that conversation with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have to start with the college kids. I was a college-age kid once back in my day, and I remember those protests where, being the head of the college Republicans, I would have protesters, no matter any event or anything that I did, they loved to protest and get mad at me out there, which was totally okay. But when we see some of these bigger rallies, are they actually there for the movement, or are a lot of them just organized? Because I see a lot of these that actually show up on a dime really quickly when something happens.
Sure. Well, I guess I question the premise a little bit. I think all protests are incentivized in some way or another. Unions, labor unions, have a long history of this. If you show up to a labor union protest, somehow you get a better shift. If you are someone who doesn't show up to any of the protests, maybe you get the graveyard shift, right? So the reality is, a lot of people, in for various reasons, are there to show up, and it's not an either or. It's not a, oh, they showed up, they're paid, they showed up, they were genuine. The reality is that everyone has an incentive to be there. Now, we're very clear about it in the sense that we actually compensate people for their attendance. But the reality is, I guess it's somewhere in the middle there. They could be paid, but they also could, they could have some backer funding them, but they could also legitimately agree with the cause. And those aren't mutually exclusive.
That makes sense. How many do you think out there are, and I guess, again, depending on what type of event, so it's kind of relative in this question, but when we see protesters that may or may not be paid, and I reference and I think of, I go back to let's say during the COVID-19 pandemic, when we saw a lot of the protests come out with Black Lives Matter and Antifa, and we see the Chad movement taking over literal blocks in Seattle, Washington, was that stuff organic, or was that fronted by some type of money behind it to make it happen?
Well, I think, again, my point here is that it can be a little bit of both, because the reality is any demonstration you see is probably a little bit of both. There's always some money behind it, right? I mean, in the sense of especially some of these demonstrations where you're having people, there are buses, there's food provided, there's signs. Some of these signs are really high quality signs. I know in my business, signs and banners are actually quite expensive, right? So in many cases, all of that is provided. I would say, though, that that doesn't take away from the fact that I think a lot of the people at some of these rallies may legitimately believe what they say. I think in regards to a couple of the ones you mentioned, so you mentioned some of the Antifa and the Chad, that's referring to the Seattle issue where they basically took over downtown parts of downtown Seattle. The reality is a lot of the people there aren't even political. They're not even leftists. They're more anarchists, right? So these are people who attach themselves. When you see a right-wing riot, they attach themselves there. When you see a left-wing riot, they attach themselves there. So the reality is they have no ideology. They just see an opportunity to loot, to pillage, in some cases to commit violent crime. And, I mean, if you look at the Rittenhouse issue in Wisconsin, right, if you look at the three individuals that were kind of alleged harm by Rittenhouse, right, these seem to be all agitators. They didn't seem to have a cohesive political ideology. These are just people who are just generic agitators. So those type of people will attach themselves to right or left wing, whoever is creating chaos and where they can insert themselves.
Yeah, amen to that. We're talking with Adam Swart. He is the protest expert, CEO of Crowds on Demand, crowdsondemand.com. Let's talk about the difference between an effective rally and protest compared to just a nuisance and annoyance. And I'll be the first to say that I will have a very hard time slowing my vehicle down if I see people in the street trying to block my road while I'm trying to get to work. I'm just saying, but that's not an effective way to actually protest and get your message across. Trying to buy meat in a grocery store and having someone scream at me saying that cow's name was Sally is not the most effective way to educate me and convince me to not eat meat in some way. So talk about in today's times how you can get the attention of people, but do it in a manner where it's effective and actually works to make people listen to you as opposed to just annoy the hell out of them.
Sure. Well, I guess I would go on with what you're saying is, in terms of my opinion, is generally blocking roads does not work. Creating major inconvenience for people who are not even the so-called culprits that you're protesting is very ineffective. It actually turns people off. Now, what it is effective at, and to be clear, we don't engage in any of that because that sure. is illegal. And we can get into why that isn't enforced later on if you want. But for the most, it's oftentimes not enforced, but it is illegal to block a road, right? I find that what isn't effective is alienating people who actually could be in your corner. I mean, you mentioned BLM. A lot of those people were screaming at people, dining at restaurants, right? I don't particularly find that effective. And I think there are a lot of people who might otherwise support them who wouldn't like that. And I think that's very ineffective. I think what helps is creating a cohesive message, having very clear signage, having yeah. flyers that you pass out that clearly indicate, here's why we're here, here's what we're here to do, and having people, not everybody is going to know the issue perfectly, but having people on site who can effectively articulate the issue. This is why we're here. This is what we're asking for, whether it's we're asking the government to do something, we're asking a corporation to do something, whatever. Now, the thing with the tactics that you mentioned is they are effective in one way, which is they get a ton of media coverage. And yeah. they are unignorable, right? So if your goal is to say, hey, look, we're being ignored, we're being silenced, we need everyone to pay attention, even if it's negative attention, well, that is a good tactic to do it. You just also have to hope that you don't get prosecuted for it. So again, my feeling is we don't engage in any of this because we follow the law in all of our demonstrations. But sometimes lawbreaking can be an effective, but I would say unethical way to get your point across.
Exactly. Yeah. No, what you guys are doing is great because you're able to actually get a message out there and get a rally. And look, even if I don't agree with someone's rally, I like having a conversation and understanding it. I say on this program all the time that if I can understand and at least understand the connection from dot A to dot B and how they get to a point and why they stand for a position, I may not agree with it, but I can respect the fact that they actually understand the issue and that they're really promoting it because they truly believe in it. I think what social media has done is making all these experts, quote unquote, by having a limit on what they can do with the number of characters in a tweet. And then all of a sudden they know this issue and they have no clue what they're talking about. And we see that in a lot of protests and rallies where they chant about something ridiculous and they don't understand the process. But if someone's out there and they come to me and be like, hey, we want to change this, we want to do this, and this is why, this is what we believe in, then I love hearing those things and I love hearing it. And whether I sign their petition or I don't or support them or not, but I can at least respect it and I understand it. I'm like, wow, they're doing it the right way. And I love seeing people passionate about what they want to change throughout the world.
Absolutely. And I think what we do is actually make it easier to get involved in causes that people believe in, because the one kind of misnomer about incentivized activism, which is what we do, is that, oh, these people, because they're being compensated, don't actually support the cause. Well, in reality, I actually find that demeaning to our folks, because at the end of the day, are you're a conservative, you're not going to go to a BLM rally or a Greenpeace rally just because someone paid you a few hundred bucks to do that, right? And conversely, that Greenpeace hippie isn't going to go to a conservative rally just because they're compensated to do it. What we're doing is actually giving voice to a lot of folks that actually, because they have jobs, they have other commitments, they have childcare, right? They actually wouldn't be able to go out and rally for the things they support because, frankly, most of us, unless you have a big trust fund, you're retired with a nice pension, whatever, you don't actually have that free time to be able to engage with the issues. So we're actually, we're just facilitating that.
Well, and that's an issue with a lot of the conservative movements is that we have rallies. I mean, I've held rallies myself and I've seen conservative rallies and it has to be late in the evening when people get off of work and it's hard to actually get them rallied because then they go home to their families and they do things with the have to go to dinner and do their stuff. So it's very difficult to actually see conservatives show up to events unless they're really, really passionate and they take that time and sacrifice that time away from work or away from their family. Hang on the line, Adam. I want to continue this conversation with you with crowdsondemand.com. Back after this, one more segment. Now we're number one here for the Voice of Reason's weekend edition. Stay right here.
This is the Voice of Reason with Andy Hoosier. Where Hoosierholics gather every week. This is the Voice of Reason with Andy Hoosier.
Darn right it is. Welcome back into it. We got a few minutes left here of hour number one of your weekend edition for the Voice of Reason. Fascinating conversation, learning kind of the inner workings of how rallies, protests, gatherings get together to change the mindsets of individuals to let people know about how you stand on a particular issue. I always find the psychology of that somewhat interesting. We're talking with Adam Swart. He is a protest expert, CEO of the company Crowds on Demand, which you can find online, crowdsondemand.com. Adam, let's talk about getting people, getting activists going, because nowadays we see voter turnout, for example, which is relatively low in our nation compared to other nations. We see anywhere between 30 to 40% of Americans actually turn out to vote. In an election, we see activism based on, you know, the fringe on, I don't want to say fringe, but the engaged individuals on either side of the aisle. Then there's a large portion in the center that just don't care. And whether it's because they're too busy working two or three jobs, whether it's because they care more about what's going on with the Kardashians, it's what's going on in our government, that they have their own personal interest and they just don't find it as an interesting or a necessity for them to actually pay attention to. Trying to engage and appeal to those types of individuals in today's world of constant ads and things thrown in your face all the time, how do you bring an awareness to an issue to try and get more people to be knowing of what's going on and be interested in it?
Well, first of all, you bring it to them and you relate it to them. And you, the one thing that you didn't mention there is sports. I think you have a ton of people who are so engaged in sports. They can tell you every sports fan stat. They can tell you some guy who played in the MLB in 2001, you know, some, you know, backup quarterback from 2005, but they don't know who their congressman or senator is. So, you know, I think you have to relate it. Certainly the left has done a better job than the right on that in terms of if you think of the celebrities who bring pop culture and politics together. That has been a very effective strategy for the left thus far. So first of all, you want to relate it to them. In terms of what protests do is they have the effect of actually educating people in their space. So now you have demonstrators outside your office building. Well, now there's an opportunity to engage where you otherwise wouldn't have, right? So you try to bring it to them and then bring it in a respectful manner and try to relate it to something that you do care about. So you might think, you might be in the center, you might just be someone who, like a disaffected voter, whose views may be not even in the center, but more all over the place, if you see what I'm saying. And those people, both parties have to let them know, hey, why should you even care about this? And why am I the person, after my party has let you down, both parties have let most of the country down for a long time, right? Why should you believe that I'm going to be any different?
Yeah, that is true. Adam, we just got about a minute left here before we have to wrap up. How important is it to tag, and you kind of mentioned it, finding something that they're interested and passionate about, but actually attaching emotion to it? And I've said that as well, that the left does a way better job on talking about political issues and tying an emotion to it, which is why you see so many really angry, emotionally fired up people on the left that are protesting the majority of the time, because they attach emotion. We're analytical. Conservatives look at the numbers. We look at budgets. We're like, it's too expensive, or inflation's too high, or taxes are too up, which we can attach an emotion to it, but it's more difficult than just saying they're coming after the women and putting you back in the kitchen. Like, that's, there's a vast difference on how an emotional attachment happens there, isn't there?
That's true. I mean, the conservatives have done a very good job with fear as well, sometimes with, okay, migrant caravan. That's a good example, right, where conservatives actually, I think, did do a good job of creating fear. Now, you as a conservative might say, well, it's rightful fear. And them as the left might say the fear of the women back in the kitchen is a rightful fear. But I think what conservatives need to do better, and the left under Obama did better, but has lacked as well, is give people hope. And I, what you see now is, I think both parties are great at fear mongering, but neither party is giving people hope. And I think you need to, they need to convey more than just the other guy's stuff.
Yeah, well, and you're right. I mean, positive campaigns win it very nicely, which is why Ronald Reagan ended up winning with only losing one state when he ran for re-election back in the 1980s. It's about that positive message, which is what people want. Adam Swart, you can check him out online, crowdsondemand.com. Adam, we appreciate the time very much, my friend. We'll have to get you back on again real soon. Always good stuff. Got to take a break. Hour number two right around the corner here for The Voice Reason. We got more to get to. We have the budget issue. We have the Supreme Court. We have Dean Clancy with Americans for Prosperity. He'll be joining us right around the corner as well. Until then, let's do this, baby. Hour number two right around the corner. So much more and so much fun. Apparently, Kay Middleton is in the news. I don't know why, but she is. We'll cover all that and more. Stay right here for The Voice Reason.